Welcome to the Bill Walton Show. I'm Bill Walton, and I'm back today with my favorite national security expert, Stephen Bryan, who's with the Center for Security Policy. And Stephen's written some very interesting material about a couple developments pertaining to Europe and its security, and in fact, the United States and our security. Number one is that the Russians have developed a missile that could be a real game changer. And the other is that there's a report by a German think tank or EU think tank about the fact that Europe may not be able to defend itself in any type of war. So with that happy news, Stephen, let's talk about the missile, which, as you said, is a real game changer.
Yeah, I think it is. It's called a Reshnik. I think that means hazel. I'm not a Russian speaker, so I'll leave it at that. It's an intermediate range ballistic missile. It was fired from a Russian base called Kapustin Yar. A Yar is a ravine. It's about 1,000 kilometers from Dnipro, where the missile hit, or about 600 miles. So it's pretty far into the western part of Russia, this base. Anyway, the missile itself is a hypersonic platform. And I believe, and I think there's no proof about this, but it's really appears to be a missile that has on top of it a hypersonic glide vehicle. Now, a hypersonic glide vehicle is designed to leave space and skim the Earth's atmosphere and then descend at hypersonic speeds to a target. The Russians developed a system like this, about 2019, called a Vanguard. And it's a nuclear system that goes on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile. The one that was used in the attack in Dnipro appears to have been equipped with conventional munitions, not nuclear. And most of the reports back that up. The rocket itself, the Reshnik, reached a speed of about 20 Mach, which is very fast.
20 Mach is around, I looked it up, 15,224 miles per hour.
Yeah, I mean, it's fast. It's better than my car. It's really fast. By the time the glide vehicle made it to release its munitions on the target, it was probably flying about half that speed, or Mach 10, 7,000, 8,000 miles an hour. And, you know, what we understand so far, and I have, by the way, an interesting eyewitness report. I'll read it to you in a second, is that it didn't have any explosives. The warheads were essentially solid iron, or I don't want to say iron because it probably wasn't, but some other hard material, probably tungsten carbide or something like that, that penetrated the earth. And what we would call a bunker buster. And eyewitnesses said, oh, it was like an earthquake. You know, we were a mile away and our house cracked. It was that violent. And it hit this old Russian base, which is used to manufacture missiles by the Ukrainians, and did a lot of damage. Since then, the Ukrainians have sealed off the site and not let any eyewitnesses any longer get near it, other than people from NATO and the United States who are coming to examine what happened. So packets of weapons, and each one of those contained between 4 and 6 submunitions. So it was somewhere between 24 and 36 penetrations of the earth at this site. It was pretty spectacular.
So the what makes this is the hyper is the 20 Mac.
Well, it's hypersonic
innovation or what?
Yeah, it's hypersonic long range. Probably there's no air defenses that can knock it out right now. So it's a formidable weapon in that sense. Now, we know that the one that the Russians fired was a test vehicle. It was not a rocket that was in serial manufacturing. In fact, when Putin, who addressed the Russian nation after the strike, said that he had ordered serial manufacturing now that it proved to be successful. It had telemetry on board. The Ukrainians say they recovered a part of the electronics that were a telemetry package, and usually use telemetry on test missiles to understand how they perform and to make changes if necessary, if they don't perform as well as you'd like. So, it was a test one. They may have a handful of these, maybe four, maybe six. I don't think any more than that in their arsenal right now. And it's possible even just one or two.
So the,
that's it.
So as I think you explained that not only does this work without explosive, but it also penetrates very deeply into the earth, and it can go right at underground bunkers and missiles that are hidden silos. And I think you said that there was an underground munitions facility, and it was simply pulverized. It was turned to dust.
Yeah, well, that's what the witnesses say. And it seems to be the case. No one is refuting that. The Ukrainians said, well, didn't do any damage because there wasn't any explosions. Okay.
Well, but doesn't this send a signal to our president of Ukraine, who's operating from an underground bunker, that it might not be
the haven that he thinks it is? I think that's exactly what the Russians wanted him to understand, that it could take out his bunker in Kiev and others like it that they've got scattered around and turn them into dust. And that's a pretty strong warning. But it didn't stop the Ukrainians. I mean, they fired another 13 ATACMS missiles over the last 3 days. So they're still at it. And I imagine the Russians will do something else now.
Well, and it didn't stop Joe Biden from asking for another $24 billion in aid to Ukraine. It seems like there's this unreality around our thinking about how we're going to deal with this, and facts on the ground don't matter. And this missile is a massive new fact. I mean, it's a game changer. It wasn't the point also that this could be, it could easily reach London or Paris.
Oh yeah. Any place in Europe would be exposed to this type of threat.
And it would have an impact of about a mile, square mile. And it can be landed.
I don't know exactly the impact. I mean, the pattern, because it would depend on the target. And, In this particular case in Dnipro, it went after two workshops, number 7 and number 8, in a very large complex. It didn't hit the rest of the complex because those were underground operations and destroyed them. So, you know, yes, it could hit anywhere, but it doesn't have to just have a conventional warhead.
Well, you meaning it could also have a nuclear warhead?
Well, it's a dual threat, yeah, because the Russians don't build anything that can't mount a nuclear weapon.
So does the United States have anything similar to this or close to it?
No. We were working on a hypersonic glide vehicle. It was Lockheed, I think, that had the contract. And they tested it a number of times, and it didn't work. So the project was stopped. So we have other hypersonic type of weapons, but they're short range, relatively short range weapons. And this is a fairly, you know, an intermediate range ballistic missiles has a couple thousand miles range. So it's not non-trivial.
Well, do we have any defense systems to protect against it?
No. As far as I know, we don't. The systems that we have, well, let's go through what we got. In Europe, we have deployed mostly Patriot. When you say Patriot, there are a lot of different versions of Patriots and evolving systems. So which ones are where is another whole story. But I don't think Patriot could intercept it. I don't think the radar is good enough to pick up a hypersonic weapon. It's too late. If anyone that watches Patriots operate in the Middle East, in the Ukraine, sees very quickly that it's largely just an area weapon with very limited intercept capability. Even though it's supposed to have a long range, the intercepts are just about overhead when they happen. So that tells me that it couldn't do any good against this weapon at all, because it's never going to be able to react fast enough to deal with it.
So we know it can reach all of Europe. Can it reach New York?
No, that would be more like the Vanguard ICBM. Okay. Sarmat is the ICBM and the Vanguard is the glide vehicle that the Russians have built, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile. That's, as far as I know, strictly nuclear. And it's an amazing thing, because it can actually go into suborbital flight and you don't know where it's going to come from. And there's a lot of issues with it, but we don't have anything that, certainly on the East Coast, we have nothing. On the West Coast, we have the ground-based interceptor, which has not done well against even supersonic targets. You know, forget about hypersonic. And it needs to be fixed. It's not a good system right now. It has a good radar, but the interceptor missiles are inadequate. And the other alternative is Aegis, which is at sea. And that depends a lot. It may be able to do something, maybe, but it has to be in the right place at the right time. And that's highly unlikely. I don't think we really have any missile defenses, right? Well, even before hypersonics, we didn't have an adequate, we don't have an adequate missile defense capability.
So what has the Pentagon been doing for the last 20 years?
Fooling around. Look, they keep putting money in the Patriot, trying to improve it. They put money in billions into the ground-based interceptor, but it doesn't work very well. Aegis appears to work, but how well, that remains to be seen. No, we haven't really taken it seriously. Part of this goes back to, remember, President Ronald Reagan proposed what he called the Strategic Defense Initiative, something that we in the often called Star Wars. But the notion was, you're not going to intercept them when they're over your head. You know, forget about it. So you got to get them when they're in space, and largely in the just post-boost part. So when they're starting to rise into space, that's the time to kill them before they release their munitions. And that he had different schemes to do that. One of them was called Brilliant Pebbles, which would be space-based mini interceptors, if you want, that would kill these Russian rockets or Chinese rockets or whoever's rockets they were. That was never built. There was fierce opposition to it because it would destroy the doctrine of what's called MAD. Now, MAD means mutually assured destruction. The notion was that if they fire at us, we're going to fire at them. We're going to destroy each other. The world's over.
Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, we have not evolved very far in that respect. But the scientists all complain, you can't do this, won't work. Scientists always complain when they have an agenda that's other than technical. but anyhow, the bottom line is it wasn't done. Although I think in some ways it was very sobering for the Soviet Union at the time and led them to desire arms deals with the United States as an alternative to constantly jacking up the nuclear threat on each side. But we're back to that now because there's nothing, you know, there's almost no agreements left to prevent ICBMs and hypersonics and all the rest.
Why didn't our intelligence services know about this?
I think they did know about it. In fact, as far as the Sarmat and the Vanguard is concerned, as part of the strategic arms agreements with Russia, the Russians actually showed it to our guys. They saw it. It wasn't something that they dreamed about, you know, or looked at from a satellite. They saw it face to face.
So we've been blithely pursuing this war in Ukraine, I mean, with this air of unreality where we're assuming American superiority, when in fact we do not have superiority. Russia does.
Well, yeah, we're making two assumptions, that we're superior, that NATO's superior. I think both of those are faulty assumptions.
Well, that bridges us to that study that you reported on, the Kiel report, Kyle report.
I think Kiel. Kiel. It's an institute in Germany. It's a think tank, a very well-regarded one. And essentially, they just looked at, are we prepared or are we not prepared? And they came to a very straightforward conclusion. We're not prepared. We can't possibly deal with the Russians right now. I think that's exactly right. The NATO people, by the way, are living in a very strange world. And it's very scary because they keep talking about, well, we're no longer a defensive alliance. We're going to be an offensive alliance. We're going to strike the Russians. Who are they kidding?
Mm-hmm.
Who are they kidding? What kind of nonsense is this? And these are supposedly smart people, admirals, generals, the head of NATO, I mean, Rutte. I mean, all these guys are mouthing this nonsense. NATO has expanded too fast. It has not built up a sufficient capability to back up the expansion that it's done. And it's hardly a defensive alliance, let alone an offensive one. And using Ukraine, which they've done, as a way to batter the Russians and to bring NATO into Ukraine, is completely crazy. It makes no sense. It doesn't make strategic sense. It's not practical. It has caused thousands and tens of thousands of dead Ukrainians and Russians. The whole thing is a disaster, total disaster.
Well, they also had an interesting piece of the report about what Germany pays for its weaponry, and we think the Pentagon is
yeah, no, they're ripoff artists there, or even exceeding ours.
What about the
Kiel report talks? You know, puts it all even simple things. You know,
what about the German air assault vehicle? That's an interesting one.
Yeah, they have no lift though. So it doesn't mean anything. There's a lot of corruption here on all fronts. I'm not saying the Russians aren't corrupt, by the way. They probably are. But the bottom line is that we invest very heavily in very expensive weapons we don't need. And neglect conventional stuff we do need and should have. And we also neglect where our interests lie. You know, our interests don't lie in Ukraine. We don't have any interest in Ukraine. We have an interest in Europe, you know, parts of NATO. We have a very important interest in the Pacific, in protecting Japan and Taiwan and Korea, places like that. Those are pretty important interests, economic, political, military, all the rest. But we're not, you know, we've done very little to strengthen our posture in the Pacific because we've dumped all our weapons into Ukraine. So we've left ourselves in a hole. It's very irresponsible.
Well, we have two months until Trump comes into office.
Yes.
And we have Biden continuing to fire off missiles through his proxy.
Well, Ukraine. He wants to go. Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing in itself. I mean, look, everybody has sort of concluded that has any sense of responsibility. Two or three people, maybe. But I mean, the general consensus is the Russians are winning the war in Ukraine. Not quickly, but winning it. And that the Ukrainians are running out of people. The situation on the front lines is dire. The casualties are, you know, they lose 1,000 guys a day. I mean, yeah. You can't do that. Just can't do that. And they can't replace them. So everyone's concluded that this war is going to hell. Biden wants to get out of office before it collapses, I think. So he wants to throw anything he can into Ukraine to hold the line, trying somehow to convince the Russians that the more is coming, it's going to get worse, not better. I mean, he wants to get out with his pants on.
He doesn't want to do what he did in Afghanistan.
That's with your pants on. Yeah,
exactly. So how would, if you were advising President Trump on how to wrap this up, what would you tell him?
Well, it's difficult for Trump because Biden has made it so much worse with these new weapons and attacks on Russian territory that the Russians are pretty pissed off. That's a technical term. So, you know, whether they're open to negotiations of some kind, the Russians said no ceasefires. So that's off the table, I think. They're not going to do that. But they may be willing to talk. And if I were Trump, I think I would start negotiating with Putin and see what you can get.
Well, what do we have? What do we have that Putin wants?
Sanctions, to get rid of the sanctions, normalization. Putin wants options, not just China. I mean, you know, he can't just rely on the Chinese because, you know, the real truth is the Chinese and the Russians don't really get along. And so he's taking a risk being a one-horse pony. He needs he needs to balance his relationships. He needs to have a relationship with the United States. And this is my opinion. I don't know if it's Putin's. he didn't call me an ass. But it seems to me if I were in the Russian position, I would want to have options. That's a good Washington term. I have to have options. and one option is to have, you know, be able to talk to the Americans, talk to the Chinese, to see what works which way. Plus, economically, you know, Russians are missing some big pieces, and they're going to be depending entirely on the Chinese for them unless they make some deals with us, electronics being one of the most prominent.
Well, the Biden administration refuses to talk to the Russians. I mean, back in the day when we had the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the way through before and after the Cold War, we've been in constant communication with them, and that's the way you can avoid catastrophe. And yet Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken, they're acting like teenagers. They're just not going to talk to Russia.
Nor are the Europeans.
And the Europeans.
Well, some of them are, actually, but...
Well, have to be some of them.
Under the table, but especially the Germans. Because the Germans have reason to be concerned about Russia. And also, it's a huge potential market for Germany, which they have taken off the table. And the German economy is ailing very badly. So they really need to get this over with and to make some deals with the Russians from an economic and political point of view. So, and look, the Germans are not going to spend on defense what they would need to spend on defense to rebuild their capabilities. So given that, and that's a prognosis because they don't have the money. And anyway, they won't spend it, even if they had the money. And anyway, their defense industry would rip most of it off anyhow. So, I mean, the bottom line for the Germans is they really need a deal. And they have an incompetent government, let's face it.
The other thing is the Ukraine war has been a proving ground for what weapons work and what weapons don't. And so I think what Russia's figured out is most everything that we thought we had, and maybe what we thought we had, doesn't work.
Well, I think that's too harsh.
Or is that an overstatement?
Let's say that whatever we've thrown in there has not proven to be a game changer.
Right.
I think that's a fair statement. I think not work is too strong. I mean, HIMARS works. It's a good system, but the Russians have figured out how to shoot down most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. But it's a very important system. But the big mistake, in my view, is that, you know, by throwing all this into Ukraine, we don't have any to use elsewhere. So we've left ourselves kind of naked, and we left our allies even more naked. There was an announcement just now by Japan that the U.S. Marines are going to be able to put HIMARS on the Japanese southern islands, the Ryukyu, I can't pronounce it right, islands, but particularly one called Yonaguni. And the reason is it's about 90 miles from, even less, from Taiwan, and any Chinese sea invasion has to cross between there and the Japanese island and Taiwan. So with HIMARS, they can shoot down and destroy these ships. So it's a very important strategic thing. But we don't have enough HIMARS because we've thrown them, you know, especially the long-range ones, which are being used in Ukraine. So what is this? Why are we doing that? We didn't safeguard our own interests here at all. So the Japanese have made an announcement. It's a very important announcement. It's a very welcome one. And it will help stabilize, I think, then tell the Chinese that if they try something, they're going to pay a price. But, you know, whether we can back it up with the hardware is another whole different story.
Have you seen anything that suggests President Trump and the people he's putting into place see this in the clear-eyed way that you've explained it?
I don't know all the Trump people, the new ones, and I haven't talked to them. Occasionally I read statements by some that make a lot of, like Vance, who makes a lot of sense to me. Tom Cotton makes a lot of sense to me, people like that, and I'm encouraged. The real problem Trump faces is being sucked into supporting what Biden started. And there's a risk that could happen.
What about Marco Rubio?
Well, I very much like Marco Rubio, and I think he's sensible when it comes to Ukraine. I think he understands the game. I think he will be a very good official for the Trump administration as Secretary of State. And that's encouraging. He's not going to be a Blinken, God forbid.
Well, that's a very low bar.
Extraordinarily low.
We've been talking about Tony Blinken for the last 2.5 years, and you know, we need to wrap it up today because there'll be a next set of events that happen. But we ended up most of our conversations with, we hope we survive until we get a new administration. And so the very good news is we can finally say we've got a next administration. We got 2 months to get through. What could happen in those 2 months before the new cops?
Well, it would help if Trump told Biden, and he told the Pentagon, stand down, no more. Stop. You know, you did enough. Stop. And let's wait until we get in office, and then we'll deal with it. Don't give the Ukrainians one more bullet. Stop. They have enough for right now, but stop. And I haven't heard that yet. Maybe they're telling them privately. But Lloyd Austin, for example, has been, you know, harsh and critical of the Trump people and Trump himself. He needs to shut up and just stop doing what they're doing. It's bad. It's dangerous. The Russians are very tense right now. We don't want them to be very tense. Lavrov is saying, well, in negotiations, that's never going to happen. It's way off in the future. This is showing you the Russian mood. And I think Trump is going to have a hard time turning that around. And he's going to have to use all his persuasive powers. Now, he's really good at it. I mean, I am tremendously impressed. I mean, he got the Mexicans to back down and the Canadians to back down in 5 minutes.
In 5 hours?
Yeah, even less. I mean, it's a tour de force. I mean, because he knows what he wants. He tells them exactly what he's going to do, and that's that. Now, Putin's another story. He's a major power. He has nuclear weapons. He's very angry with the United States and with NATO. It's going to take a lot of work to settle that out. And a part of the deal here is not just Ukraine. They have to settle how they're going to manage the situation in Europe, too. And I think that's critical. And that's, by the way, what before this war started in December of 2021, right before, and February is when in 2022 is when it started. The Russians sent a letter to the United States and sent a letter to NATO, and they said, among other things, they wanted to settle the overall security situation of Europe. And that was, you know, basically Washington told them, go forget about it. We're not interested. We should be interested. The Europeans should be interested. The Europeans don't need to spend what little revenues they have and wasted on Ukraine. And they need to get realistic about their own economies and their own political future because things are changing in Europe.
So, my friend Matt Whitaker is going to be our ambassador to NATO, and that's going to be a tough job because I don't see a future for NATO, given everything that's evolved here. I mean, it's you know, what's it mean? What's it stand for? What's it want to do? And these countries are interested are no longer aligned. I don't think it holds up.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's got a big challenge. I've written a lot about this and basically said, look, NATO was created as a defensive alliance, and that's its real role. The idea of NATO as an expansionist alliance is very dangerous because it invites trouble, and there's no reason for that trouble. What do we gain by adding, let's say, in the perfect world, what would we gain by adding Ukraine to NATO? It would be of no particular significance for us, except that it would invite a war with Russia. Why do you want that? The Russians have made that clear. It's a red line. And it's an unbridgeable red line. So the bottom line is I think NATO needs to be reassessed. And it would be very helpful if the Trump administration carries out such a reassessment and defines the parameters of what the NATO alliance is and what it isn't. And that would be a big step forward.
Stephen Bryan, thank you. Center for Security Policy. You write brilliantly at your Substack site, Weapons and Strategy. How do we find that? We look you up on Substack.
Say again.
What are your coordinates?
Just go to Substack and write Weapons and Strategy, and you'll go right there.
Okay.
And subscribe. I mean, like subscribers, you know.
And paid subscribers are even better.
No, I don't take any money.
You don't take any money?
No. It's a free site.
Yeah.
I don't take a nickel. I don't want a nickel. I'm trying to do this. You know, I'm an old man. So I do this as a public service. It's my contribution to the common good. I like to think about it.
It's huge. I mean, you're my go-to guy to understand what's really going on. So keep going, and we'll be back, I'm sure, with the next big development. So thanks a lot.
You're more than welcome. Take care.
Okay, and thanks for joining us on the Bill Walton Show. And you can find us on all the major podcast platforms and on Substack. So stay tuned for other shows like this, and look forward to seeing you, talking with you in the future.